planet Tatooine. Too many science fiction movies give us aliens who look like humans with funny heads. When Spielberg gave us spindly child creatures in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, I found that fascinating. And when Lucas gives us Jar Jar, with his eyes perched on stalks growing atop his kangaroo rabbit donkey head, with his weirdly backward speech, with his body language that seems generated by second thoughts, I am delighted. If it takes animation to make a creature like that, well, I'm glad they can do it. However, as the first sneak previews gave way to the press screenings and then the wide release, and critics and audiences saw the film, reaction slowly began to turn more and more sour. Well before the May 19th release, most critics found the film rather uninspiring, and in fact, its worst reviews were among the earliest. Richard Corliss, who had surmised that the characters might be well-developed, and whom had shown fascination with Jar Jar in the film's plot, now, after actually seeing the film, complained how dull and lifeless the story was. Much of the reaction from the older Star Wars fans was lackluster, and as the fans who had camped out for weeks outside theaters finally saw the film, many were unsurprisingly disappointed. Far from any work of genius, the film was remarkably average, and the world had not waited for a film that was ultimately deemed so-so. As the uncontrollable hype and mountainous expectations all converged into the film's release date, it was perhaps inevitable that critics would react against these things. Criticizing the film soon became a trend, and Lucas himself became the target of much abuse, being labeled a bloated, soulless technocrat without any sense of emotional storytelling. The internet, in particular, was an outlet of bitter despondency. Many ethnic minority groups voiced efforts to boycott the film, alleging everything from the Nemoidians being Asian stereotypes, to Watto being an Arab stereotype, to Jar Jar being a Rastafarian stereotype. Even homosexual groups went after Jar Jar. This infamous character took the brunt of the abuse, upheld as an effigy for all that was wrong with the film, as older fans saw his comedic antics and lowbrow humor as utterly disgraceful, with entire anti-Jar Jar web groups springing up, such as the now defunct JarJarBinksMustDie.com. Meanwhile, in the fan community, a bitter civil war was being waged online, with the camps split into Phantom Menace bashers and gushers, who expressed brazen hatred and love for the film, respectively. However, regardless of this over-the-top harshness from certain groups of people, the film was an all-out box office success. Children loved the film, as did many fans and casual moviegoers, and the movie went on to gross well over $400 million domestically. But nevertheless, it was ultimately regarded as a critical failure. A visually impressive film fraught with many fundamental flaws, and after a 16-year wait, many felt let down. Although the film was the single highest-grossing release in the entire Star Wars series, and broke practically every box office record in history except for Titanic's, much of this was due to the fact that every fan of the original trilogy showed up, expecting it to recapture the magic of those films. Utterly perplexed by the averageness of the film, many did not return for the sequel, or at least did not see it more than once, as did many non-fans who saw Episode 1 out of curiosity, hence leading to Episode 2's box office gross to be massively smaller than that of its predecessor. A great many still hoped that the two remainders would improve, and hence saw the films despite their disappointment. Even Walter Murch felt Lucas had lost his touch.
"For me, those films pummel you into submission," he told Wired in 2005. "You say, okay, there are 20,000 robots walking across the field. If you told me a 14-year-old had done them on his home computer, I would get very excited. But if you told me it's George Lucas, with all of the resources available to him, I know it's amazing. But I don't feel it's amazing. I think if George were here and we could wrestle him onto the carpet, he'd say, 'Yeah, I've gotten into that box, and now I want to get out of that box.'"
The thing about Star Wars for me Ewan McGregor remarked in 2006, is that I'll always hold the first three in the 70s with just huge regard, and the ones I did as the ones I did. In retrospect, many who hated the film upon initial viewing have since softened up on their criticism. Frank Darabont gives an honest, if defensive, assessment of the out-of-control criticism the film endured in a 2000 interview. Creative screenwriting. You're quoted as telling George Lucas, "I wouldn't change a single damn word, and I hope he didn't." Is the script you read what everyone else saw on the screen? Darabont. It is very much the movie that hit the screen. I still like it very much. I find the backlash perplexing and a little disheartening. To hear some people tell it, it's like crapping on the Mona Lisa. But this has more to do with people's expectations, which were so very high, more than it has to do with the quality of the resulting film. No film could possibly have pleased them. It's hard to have perspective when you're in the heat of the moment. I think Phantom Menace will be assessed some years down the road more fairly than it is now. I thought it was a very smart film. I thought it worked. And what is this, "oh, it's just for kids" comment? What is that about? Who the hell do you think any of the Star Wars films were for? They were very much in that milieu of mythology for children. What's the problem? The problem is that everybody who saw those movies has grown up, and their memory of the impact of those films has been diluted through the years. The films have become so iconic that disappointment was inevitable. George Lucas is capable of many, many things, but making you feel like that wonderstruck 8-year-old again isn't one of them. It can't be done. You're not 8 years old. You can't be wonderstruck in the same way. Sorry. In terms of its intelligence and its approach, I'd put Menace up there with Empire Strikes Back, which was the darkest and most adult of the original trilogy. Typically, whether valid or not, every popular film inevitably becomes victimized with unfair criticism, simply out of the fact that it is a popular film. The Matrix and Lord of the Rings endured similar accusations of racism shortly after, as did the original Star Wars, with nary a colored person to be seen on screen. American Graffiti was accused of being chauvinistic. In fact, modern audiences may forget that in 1977, there eventually arose some critical recoil as well. Star Wars came out of nowhere, and while critics loved the film as a moving, if brainless, adventure flick, it was the audiences that went ballistic over it. It opened humbly in some 32 theaters without any major stars. Its popularity grew through word of mouth, and the film became an instant hit. However, as it grew in popularity, backlash rose up against it, if only in small pockets. It was criticized for its lack of roles by women and visible minorities, and for supposed racial portrayals of everyone from Arabs to the English. Some critics bashed its wooden dialogue, cardboard acting, and simple story. As the film became known as a science fiction movie, some hardcore sci-fi fans began to attack the movie, claiming it was an insult to realistic science fiction. Of course, those critics in 1977 were a small minority, and so their efforts gradually faded away. Phantom Menace, on the other hand, was faced with a bevy of attacks, tempered only by the fact that the film had nonetheless become a box office hit. The criticism that Jar Jar Binks represented a stereotypical and racist depiction of Rastafarians as funny-talking, funny-walking, slow-witted, inept comedians was a constant accusation leveled at Lucas and the film. Much evidence was brought forward in favor of the accusations, from comparisons of Jar Jar's floppy ears to dreadlocks, to parallels of his speech, Yusa, Misa, to his name, Jah is the Rastafarian god, to the fact that the actor who played him was black. George Lucas, of course, is an avid fan of silent film, especially the slapstick genre of the 1920s and 1930s, and came to be exposed to the material through film school. Regardless of Jar Jar's racial origins, the character is very clearly based off the physical comedians of that era, such as Buster Keaton, as Lucas readily admits. Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd, Laurel and Hardy, and the Marx Brothers all grew out of this time period, later followed by the more juvenile hijinks of the Three Stooges, and Tex Avery's cartoon embodiments such as Looney Tunes. In the first installment of the Episode 1 web documentaries, on the first day of writing Episode 1, Lucas pops a VHS tape into his VCR and watches an old, silent-era comedy. Two frantic actors race along the top of a train, desperately trying to avoid being driven into the archway of a tunnel, eventually tumbling off. "How?" Lucas says incredulously at the hilariously impressive display of physicality.
"How do they do that?"
It is easy to see a direct connection to Jar Jar, haphazardly juggling items in Watto's shop and outrunning rampaging tanks in the film's climax. The major influence for Jar Jar was a lot of Buster Keaton, actor Ahmed Best explained to StarWars.com. But as far as comedy and timing, for me, it was Bugs Bunny. And there were a couple of Buster Keaton movies that we were inspired by for some of the scenes, especially in the army scene in Episode 1. Beyond the usual suspects of Buster Keaton and Tex Avery, there is another comedian of this period that is often deliberately overlooked because of modern political correctness, but is nonetheless a significant part of film history. That man is Lincoln Theodore Monroe Andrew Perry, commonly known under his stage name, Stepin Fetchit, the first black actor to become a millionaire. Stepin Fetchit was a legendary black comedian known for his slapstick humor in the 1920s and 1930s, in which he played inept, slow-witted servants who always seemed to get in the way of things. His popularity rode on the wave of the then-popular blackface style of comedy, which had just given way to black comedians such as Fetchit. Though it's unlikely that Lucas would deliberately design Jar Jar to emulate a racial stereotype, there are some observers, such as Columbia University's professor of African American Studies, Michael Dyson, that argue that in borrowing from the adventure and comedy films of the 1930s, Lucas unwittingly also borrowed their cultural stereotypes on some level. While Jar Jar's brand of humor, unintelligent construction, and the casting of a black actor in the part can be overlooked as coincidence, it is strange that in this context, Lucas made the decision to give Jar Jar speech patterns that distinctly recall Caribbean and African stereotypes of America's past. Terms like Misa, Yusa, Muy Muy, and Ja are strongly related to said stereotypes, and even invented words such as bombad share a level of etymological similarity, which implements some degree of design on the part of Lucas. With the character introducing himself, Misa, your humble servant, in a manner which would be at home with any of the minority roles in some of the Three Stooges shorts, Lucas might have been subconsciously shaping the character to emulate those roles, which are transmitted to us mainly through the film material of the 20s and 30s. Even the beloved serial films themselves are guilty of perpetuating these types of characters. Whatever the case, one can see that Jar Jar's racial origins become evident in his character alone. Other Gungans in the film, such as Captain Tarples and Boss Nass, have some of the same mannerisms, physical details, and speech patterns, yet do not evoke as strong racial comparisons. Nor were they accused of any. The point is still very subjective. Millions saw the film without any thought of racial overtones. Lucas himself was incredulous to the accusations. In a July 14, 1999 interview on BBC's Newsnight program, he exclaimed, "How in the world you could take an orange amphibian and say that he's a Jamaican? It's completely absurd." He went on to defend that the accusations started out as a way of selling newspapers, and decried,
"What happened was, now with the internet, the American press uses the internet as their source for everything. So when people were creating websites saying, let's get rid of Jar Jar Binks, he's terrible and everything, and some of the critics described him as a kind of comic sidekick step-and-fetch-it character, and then they say, oh, it's racist. So they come in and they start calling the film racist. It's very ironic that you have, in this particular film, the head Jedi is an African-American. Nobody even mentions that. And you have an orange alien character that speaks in a foreign language. It's like Yoda. He speaks more like Yoda than anything else.
Nevertheless, the backlash that Phantom Menace endured seems to have affected Lucas, and perhaps the following two screenplays. Jar Jar, a vital character who had more screen time than Obi-Wan Kenobi in Phantom Menace, was reduced to an ancillary character in Episode 2 and was practically absent from the third film, nor were the equally hated Gungans ever heard from again. Had the character been a hit, he would have surely found a significant place in the following films. Additionally, the midi-chlorians, a key story aspect of Episode 1, were not to be made mention of again, except in passing in Episode 3, after fans bitterly complained that they reduced the spiritual aspect of the Force to science. One has to wonder if Lucas bowed down, ever so slightly, to the pressure placed on him by the onslaught of attacks. Episode 2 would be distinguished by containing a number of elements which cater specifically to fans, foregoing Gungans and Jar Jar in favor of Boba Fett, the Tatooine homestead, and Jedi battles. When designing the Episode 2 Yoda, Lucas is heard remarking during a design meeting,
"The secret is making the new CG Yoda look like a rubber puppet. The problem we got to last time on Phantom Menace was that when they made the upgrade, it didn't look like the original trilogy rubber puppet anymore. So then everybody complained that he didn't look real. But they were saying, well, he looks better than he did before. Yeah, they made him better, but people don't like that. They want him to look like he did in the first film."
The critical reaction to Episode 1 proved an interesting example of how the contemporary world had shifted in its media and communication. With such a large emphasis placed on the mass media which permeates our culture, often entertainment-obsessed, as well as the massive shift in public opinion due to the voice provided by the newly emerged internet, the criticism of Phantom Menace was heard loud and clear, especially with so many millions of fans of the series. A consistent defense of the film, and the prequels in general, remains in the fact that a close inspection of the actual reaction and reviews indicates Phantom Menace was better received than any of the original Star Wars sequels. In fact, the prequel trilogy as a whole was better reviewed than the original trilogy. This infamous notion comes courtesy of Rotten Tomatoes, a portal site that collects movie reviews and averages their ratings, which conducted an interesting experiment following the release of Revenge of the Sith. They compared the reviews of all six films. The problem when comparing reviews is that most available today are written retrospectively. With the original trilogy regarded as magical classics, many of those reviewing the films today were kids themselves when they first saw them. Predictably, you will find nary a negative review of any of the original films. To solve this roadblock in assessing true measures of the film's critical success, Rotten Tomatoes ignored all praise-laden contemporary reviews of the original trilogy, and instead dug up as many reviews from their original release as could be found. Because most of the original reviews, and in particular the negative ones, were not available online, library archives served as the reservoir for dozens of vintage reviews of the original films during their initial releases. The website then took an average of each film's total ratings, gauged with a device affectionately termed the tomato meter, to arrive at a true critical measure of each film. Their results were surprising. Tomato meter scores for original trilogy during original release dates: 31% Return of the Jedi, 52% The Empire Strikes Back, 79% Star Wars. Average tomato meter, 54%. As one can see, only Star Wars managed to be fresh, with a respectable 79% on the tomato meter. while the other two sequels got successively worse. Most of the critics thought the first film was an inventive, fun, and entertaining summer popcorn movie. It's interesting that they complain about the dialogue back then, too. Empire, which is regarded as the best of the series nowadays, only managed to score a mixed 52%. It received great technical grades, but critics had problems with the plot one way or the other, and thought it was just minor entertainment. It got worse with Jedi: uneven pacing, no character development, tired acting, and hollow and junky filmmaking. It scored a moldy 30% on the tomato meter. Prequels were probably the last thing critics wanted back then, after the thrashing of the last film. Ironically, if you compare the average tomato meter of the prequels and the original trilogies during the time of their respective original release dates, the prequels are actually better reviewed by 16%, 70% to 54% respectively. Tomato meter ranking of Star Wars series based on critical reaction during original release dates. 83% Star Wars Episode III: Revenge of the Sith. 79% Star Wars. 65% Star Wars Episode II: Attack of the Clones. 62% Star Wars Episode I: The Phantom Menace. 52% The Empire Strikes Back. 31% Return of the Jedi. This would seem to reveal a very interesting facet of the contemporary world. Although the films were allegedly better received by the media, the public opinion is that they were, save perhaps for Episode III, failures and bitter disappointments. What is the cause of this massive contradiction? One explanation states that the prequels were the first time Star Wars sequels had premiered in a globalized, web-connected online world, and more importantly, with a well-established fan base. Indeed, had the original sequels been released during the era of the Internet, their status as treasured classics might be tarnished by bashing and complaints from the more jaded online viewers. But what was forgotten was that while many adults enjoyed the original films as well, the films had endured largely through the legacy of children. Adults had always criticized the films, but the real audience the movies were intended for, kids, loved them. And now, in the online world, while adults were given a loud and clear voice to spread their criticism and disappointment with, the real audience of the films remained silent. The children. The Phantom Menace was a sleeper hit with kids, and you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone under 12 who didn't enjoy the film, which is unsurprising, given that Phantom Menace is the most child-targeted film of the series. Lucas himself realized this age divide, as he attested in an interview at Cannes in 2005.
"We've discovered that we have two fan bases. One is over 25, and one is under 25. The over 25 fan base is loyal to the first three films, and they are actually in their 30s and 40s now, so that they're in control of the media, they're in control of the web, they're in control of everything, basically. The films, which those people don't like, which are the prequels, actually are fanatically bored by the other two. And if you get on the web and you listen to these conversations, they are always at each other's throats, and the devotion for each group is pretty equal."
However, this issue is not so cut and dried as it may seem. For starters, Star Wars swept the awards in 1977. It was not children who nominated the film for Best Picture at the Oscars. It was as much a hit to adults. What is not apparent is that Rotten Tomatoes' study is fraught with fundamental inaccuracies. The prequel's rating comes from a majority of website sources rather than legitimate publications, such as Ain't It Cool News, Dark Horizons, and Chud, while the original trilogy rating sources Newsweek, The New Yorker, and Chicago Sun-Times, very different sets of viewers. Rotten Tomatoes is aware of the slant that their web-based majority causes and offers a feature to counteract this, a top critics selection that discounts sources such as websites and takes its ratings from the more legitimate sources such as Variety, Rolling Stone, and major newspapers. Since their rating for the original trilogy is only based off these types of sources, this is the only fair comparison to make. When we make this adjustment, Revenge of the Sith's proud 83% drops to a less impressive 68%, and the other films change accordingly. Phantom Menace, 40%. Attack of the Clones, 37%. Revenge of the Sith, 68%. Trilogy average, 48%. This, not surprisingly, better reflects the public's collective memory of the film's reception and the media artifacts from 1999 to 2005, which held that Phantom Menace was a great disappointment, Attack of the Clones had embarrassing acting and writing, but that Revenge of the Sith was surprisingly watchable. On the other hand, the original trilogy is nonetheless revealed to have been not as treasured as it is regarded today. Star Wars was an instant critical hit when it was released, scoring an impressive 79% on the tomato meter, but its reputation grew rapidly thereafter. Following in the release pattern of its era, it premiered on a small number of screens, which then expanded exponentially as word of mouth helped generate the overhead needed for the increased number of theater bookings. After a month, it was generating much more than an 80% critical approval rating, and was being labeled in Time as the year's best movie, and quickly proceeded to become the most successful film in box office history, garnering 7 Oscars that year, including nominations for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Supporting Actor. Highly prestigious nominations, on par with Godfather or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, in addition to all the technical nominations it also earned. Adults were equally fond of the film as their younger counterparts. Star Wars was not a children's film, though its subject matter was appealing to them, similar in this respect to Lord of the Rings. It was a film that was accessible to everyone, that was universal in a way that anyone could relate to, regardless of whether or not spaceships and doomsday devices were your cup of tea. Its sequels, however, were not. They were accessible mostly to fans of the first film, and to those of the science fiction and fantasy fan base, delving deeper into the film's own universe and mythology, and with characters no longer in need of introduction. Moviegoers who otherwise would never have an interest in a science fiction or fantasy film, but had nonetheless enjoyed Star Wars, ventured back to see if its sequel tickled them in the same way. Unsurprisingly, many were turned off, mostly due to the nature of the material itself. This is why Empire had such a divided, love it or hate it initial reaction. Most devoted fans of Star Wars, which included adults and newspaper critics, liked the film, but many moviegoers who didn't necessarily consider themselves fans of the series did not. This then results in its corresponding 52% tomato meter rating. Star Wars appealed to the same people who voted Annie Hall Best Picture at the 1978 Oscars. It functioned as contemporary art by being culturally relevant and culturally ironic. By contrast, Empire Strikes Back is more of a traditional or normal sci-fantasy film, just told with A-list credentials. It was not as fresh and surprising in the same manner that Star Wars was, and didn't have as much broad appeal. Released today, it might be hailed as a minor masterpiece. But in 1980, critics reserved that label only for traditional dramas with important messages, like The Deer Hunter or Taxi Driver. Many people were turned off by a sci-fantasy drama that took itself as seriously as Empire did, which reminds us how much things have changed in the modern world, where the practically melodramatic Return of the King swept almost every Oscar award in 2004. But it was Return of the Jedi that truly disappointed. No longer were there divides between moviegoers who had loved Star Wars and fans of the series, but now the fans themselves split. Return of the Jedi was a film made exclusively for fans of the first two films. It was the second part of Empire Strikes Back, with characters and plot points that the film assumes the audience is already familiar with, and with in-jokes and references to the previous entries. This, of course, meant that many casual moviegoers, the same ones who were enraptured by the universality of the original film, would be instantly turned off. But even worse, many fans who had liked Empire were disappointed by the film, feeling it dull and contrived, and this continues even to this day. This is reflected in its lowly 31% rating. In fact, it might not be accurate to say that the two Star Wars sequels were originally received poorly, but then became known as classics. Rather, it was only Empire that underwent a significant reappraisal. Kids historically have preferred Return of the Jedi to Empire Strikes Back, which is no surprise given the content of the two films. But as the 8-year-olds who first saw Jedi in 1983 grew up, they realized that Empire was in fact a much more sophisticated and mature film. And critics too began to understand that there was much more to the film than they first judged. Which is why in the 1990s, Empire suddenly became known as one of the great sequels of all time, and a film that was equal or superior to its predecessor. Return of the Jedi continued to be criticized as a much weaker film, though not with the harshness of its original release. Over time, of course, the fans of the series made their way online. Casual moviegoers had no more to say about the series. They had paid a combined $300 million to see Star Wars in 1977, watched it, loved it, and moved on. Those who were fans of all three films, however, grouped together and shared their views. This continues to provide a slanted worldview in the fan community, where most of their points of reference come from themselves and not the general public. It was here that Empire Strikes Back became known as the best of the series. For many fans of the original, it expanded on the mythology and provided a mature exploration and a dark sophistication that only appreciates as one ages. Return of the Jedi was still criticized as the weakest of the three. But as the concluding entry, the second half of fan-favorite Empire, it was tolerated. By this point, however, the films were being regarded as magical classics, modern masterpieces. Especially since the generation who were youngsters at the time of original release were now adults, and also now in control of much of the media. Yet when the series was re-released in 1997, it was not Empire that rocked the box office. It was, as always, the public's favorite, the movie everybody loved, Star Wars. The Star Wars Special Edition made an astounding $138 million in theaters. It was and is arguably the most popular film ever made. Empire Strikes Back, the film that most fans of the series even to this day say is the best, made less than half of that, $67 million, though still impressive. Return of the Jedi, the film which fans consider not as good as Empire or Star Wars, made a corresponding third of the original, a scant $45 million, being attended to exclusively by devotees. The still impressive amount is a good indication of the vast amount of followers the franchise had amassed by this point, the height of the Star Wars Renaissance. Even in 1997, the two sequels combined couldn't equal what Star Wars still managed. The sequels, and hence the overall series, endured mostly due to the hordes of fans, who regarded the films and cemented their reputation into cinema history. But it was truly only the original film that was ever considered a masterpiece by critics and the general public. Lucas gave the fans their own masterpiece with Empire Strikes Back. It is a rare example of a sequel, not only considered good by most public opinion, but better than the original by many fans. Sequels typically are not well regarded, even by followers of the respective series. Ghostbusters 2 and Die Hard 2 have their devotees, but even they regard the originals as much superior. Empire accomplished that rare feat of not only matching the original, but for many, surpassing it. The Star Wars series was now at consistent level of high craftsmanship and artistic brilliance, and many expected Lucas to deliver again, especially since the story was not wrapped at the end of the second film. Unsurprisingly, the rest of the entries were closer to the level of quality normally attained in franchise sequels, average overall, but regarded to varying degrees by devotees of the series. Empire set up the expectation that every episode would be brilliant. Return of the Jedi was included in the pantheon of Star Wars and Empire because it was the conclusion to them, the second half of a sequel considered better than the original, and the climax of those two fantastic films. It was a film viewed as flawed and uneven, but it was tolerated because it rode on the coattails of the first two films. Phantom Menace, of course, had no coattails to ride on, except for fan nostalgia of the originals. It had to start the story over, introduce a new cast, and survive on its own, and the same flaws seen in lesser degrees in Return of the Jedi suddenly were exposed without any sort of crutch. Phantom Menace was, of course, unfairly reviled, and many moviegoers truly were unprepared for a film that was predominantly meant for children, rather than everyone, blindsided by the pre-release marketing that focused on the tragic and mature nature of the prequel trilogy, and did not correctly set up expectation that the movie would be so light and juvenile.
"I gave the fans as much as I could. I gave them 110%,
Lucas insisted in a Cinescape interview. "George worked very hard on it," Coppola defended him in a CNN report. "I know he's gotten some bad reviews, but he didn't slough it off or anything." In the aftermath of the criticism, Lucas would report a number of justifications to explain the criticism. People weren't interested in a film revolving around a child. People wanted to see Darth Vader killing everyone. People wanted to see more serious subject matter and not Saturday matinee material. In truth, the juggernaut hype machine, bloodthirsty media, nostalgic fan memories, and more colorful plotting indeed helped bring down the film's reception. But with all the criticism the film continues to receive from fans and non-fans alike, it would be ignorant to say that the movie simply was misunderstood. Had the material been presented in a more dramatically engaging manner, audiences would have fallen in love with the light-hearted adventure fantasy that Episode I's story presents, as they would with such similarly styled films that came out shortly after, such as Harry Potter, Chronicles of Narnia, and Fellowship of the Ring. Could it be that Lucas simply reached his peak in 1977? It is not an unfamiliar occurrence. Few directors have the consistent longevity of, for example, Steven Spielberg or Martin Scorsese. Even Coppola could not even come close to his achievements of the 70s, despite a few notable, if overlooked, feats such as Rumblefish and Tucker. Irvin Kershner, the supposed genius responsible for the majesty of Empire Strikes Back, could only follow that film up with such deplorable efforts as Never Say Never Again and RoboCop 2. Even without the pre-release hoopla, The Phantom Menace would be a considerable letdown, the Los Angeles Times reported in 1999. While the new film is certainly serviceable, it's noticeably lacking in warmth and humor, and though its visual strengths are real and considerable, from a dramatic point of view, it's ponderous and plodding. Behind the scenes, even Lucas secretly suspected that the film had problems.
"It's a little disjointed,"
he mused in the silent aftermath of the rough-cut screening.
"It's bold, in terms of jerking people around, but..."
He paused and shook his head.
"I may have gone too far in a few places."
Afterwards, Rick McCallum assured him the film was fine, but Lucas discussed ways to alleviate the problems.
"It's a very hard movie to follow, and at the same time I've done it a little more extremely than I ever have in the past. It's stylistically designed to be that way, and you can't undo that. But we can diminish the effects of it. We can slow it down a little bit. If it's intense for us, a regular person is going to go nuts."
Even the actors of the film were put off by the impersonal experience of making it. Just days before the film premiered, a disgruntled Liam Neeson announced he was retiring from the tedious and superficial world of movie making.
"Honest to God, I don't want to do it anymore," he said. "I don't think I can live with the inauthenticity of movies anymore. I don't like watching them, especially my own stuff.
Terence Stamp also lamented the disappointing experience of filming Phantom Menace. When I walked onto the set, no Natalie Portman. We've given Natalie the day off, they said. That bit of paper on the post? That's Natalie. Deliver your lines to the paper. The movie was a bit disappointing, but then it's not possible to feel empathy when you're watching something done digitally. You're not responding to a human. As a filmmaker and as a person, I can say I always had problems with Jar Jar as he started to develop in the screenplay. Rick McCallum admitted to Starburst in 1999. I loved him on paper, actually, more than I did when I saw the animation starting to come out. There was a point where I said, George, is this working? Is this really... And George said, remember, just remember. Try to find that moment. What did you love to do with your parents? Bug them. Annoy them. We will only know if George was right after the film opens. Getting personal. Lucas was doing his best to keep his head up, but the maliciousness with which the film was attacked took a toll on the filmmaker. He spoke with Leslie Stahl a few years later. Leslie Stahl, when the critics go after your writing, your directing, it has to hurt. Lucas,
oh, it always hurts. It hurts a great deal. But part of making movies is you get attacked, and sometimes in very personal ways. The point is, it's like if you paint your house white, and somebody comes over, well, that should be a greenhouse. Well, fine, but I wanted to paint it white. I don't think there was anything wrong with painting it white. I don't think there's anything wrong with me for painting it white. Maybe it should be a greenhouse, but I didn't want it to be a greenhouse. I wanted it to be a White House.
The backlash must have been especially disheartening, since Episode 1 was such a labor of love for Lucas. Rather than simply adapt his prequel notes, he created a mostly original story from scratch, an entirely new world with original characters that took over 5 years to create, filled with his signature eccentricities and quirky humor. Especially since it was his long-awaited return to directing, the relentless criticism must have been heartbreaking.
Everything I write is my life. I'm not writing some sort of hypothetical thesis on something. I'm writing a story that I have to get extremely emotionally involved in because it's going to take 2 or 3 years of my life to do it. So I can't just sort of say, well, this will be fun, and knock it off in a week. This is like a marriage. You have to be in love with this thing for at least 4 or 5 years, and probably for the rest of your life.
Although one could easily presume that the fantastic and impossible world of Star Wars has little personal connection to George Lucas's private life, there may indeed be more of him in Star Wars than he realizes. Lucas's escape from Modesto, the act of leaving the safety of the small town in which he was raised, seems to find its way into virtually every film he has made. In Star Wars, the most identifying theme was naive Luke wanting to leave the mundane confines of his farm and explore the galaxy. It was Modesto, transposed to the space fantasy vernacular, with the isolated Walnut Ranch turned into a desolate moisture farm. Irritable George Lucas Sr. turned into grumpy Uncle Owen. Sympathetic Dorothy Lucas turned into kind-hearted Aunt Beru. And young Lucas turned into young Luke, who wastes time with his friends, as his uncle scoffs, and races T-16s for fun, but dreams of bigger things.
The auteur theory of film actually is very true if you know directors,
Lucas once said,
because they are very much like their movies. And in the case of somebody who writes and directs, it is my life.
Luke's battling of his father is also a theme which stems from Lucas's tumultuous relationship with his own dad. Vader's offer of the Empire to Luke parallels Lucas Sr.'s offer of his Modesto business to his son. Join me and we can rule the galaxy as father and son. But like Lucas, Luke refuses, vowing to never be like him. Luke's horrific realization that his worst enemy is his father, and that he could become like him, perhaps the most significant thematic point for Luke, also parallels Lucas's gradual progression to the businessman he swore he would never be, exactly like his father.
I've become the very thing I swore to destroy.
Lucas admitted in 2004, as he is now transformed into the type of studio executive he once loathed. Lucas clashed with his father throughout his childhood, culminating in the moment when he refused his father's offer to take over the L.M. Morris stationery business. The event created a rift between them for years. His father was sure his son would never amount to anything, and hated the idea of him getting into the film industry. When his son became the most successful filmmaker of all time, and millionaire to boot, George's father changed his mind. He raved about his son to everyone, telling them what a success his young George was. Their relationship was finally resolved. In this can also be seen the redemption of Darth Vader, as Luke finally reconciles with his father. Lucas's own reconciliation had occurred only a few years prior to the writing of Return of the Jedi.
"There is a lot more of me in Star Wars than I care to admit, for better or worse," he said to Denise Worrell. "A lot of it is very unconscious, very personal. You can't get away from that. It comes out of you. It's not something that is done by the numbers. It's very personal. Luke, more or less, is my alter ego. He can't not be."
In 1977, Lucas said,
"I wasted 4 years of my life cruising like the kids in American Graffiti, and now I'm on an intergalactic dream of heroism. In Star Wars, I'm telling the story of me."
One cynic, in advance of its completion, has called it American Graffiti in Outer Space, Steven Zito wrote about Star Wars in 1977, with all the autobiographical implications that comment suggests. Mark Hamill finally understood his character once he got to know Lucas personally. "George is Luke," Hamill said in the making of Star Wars. "He is. I always felt that way. We were in the desert one time. It was the scene where I had just found R2 after he ran away. So I ran up and said, 'Hey, where do you think you're going?' And to 3PO, 'Do you think I should replace the restraining bolt?' But George came up to me and said, 'It's not a big deal.' He acted it out, just walking up and saying, 'No, I don't think he's going to try anything.' At that point, I was thinking, well, he's doing it so small, so I'll do it just like him, and he'll see how wrong he is. So I did it like that, and he said, 'Cut, print it, perfect.' So I thought, 'Oh, I see.' After that, I often felt like I was playing George." If Lucas's personal history is charted through Luke in the original trilogy, the events since then are charted through Anakin in the prequel trilogy. Lucas was hailed as the greatest storyteller who ever lived, the savior of cinema, put on a pedestal so high that he was threatened with losing touch with reality. His status as mythmaker was so disproportionate to the humble realities he suspected about himself that he knew he could never satisfy everyone. He proved this with the release of Episode I. He was destined to fail. It is no surprise, then, that the protagonist of the prequel trilogy is introduced in a similar manner. A humble slave boy who is snatched up and proclaimed as the greatest Jedi to ever live, the Chosen One, whom all are disappointed with when it is revealed he is not performing to their expectations. The issue of conception is also a very significant factor, as Lucas himself is cursed with sterility. When he learned the news, it was difficult for him to accept at first, but he soon learned to overcome this barrier with an unnatural way of bearing children, adoption. Small wonder, then, that Anakin is also surrounded with unnatural conception, first in his fatherless virginal birth, and then when Palpatine reveals that Darth Plagueis created life purely through the Force. Anakin's circular fate in Episode 3 also draws a parallel to Lucas's. Anakin swears to destroy the Sith, but ends up becoming one, and Anakin's attempts to save his wife only end up killing her.
"I'm not happy that corporations have taken over the film industry, but now I find myself being the head of a corporation, so there's a certain irony there," Lucas admitted to Wired magazine in 2005. "I have become the very thing that I was trying to avoid. That is Darth Vader. He becomes the very thing he was trying to protect himself against."
His attempt to break free of Hollywood only resulted in him becoming a prime representative of the mogul-like billionaire atmosphere so associated with Tinseltown, and his determination to funnel the profits of Star Wars into securing personal and financial freedom for himself and his wife only resulted in their divorce. Like Anakin, it was at first a means to an end, to living comfortably and having personal and financial freedom, but soon it became an ends to itself, as his empire ballooned to grand heights. He told Marcia that he was doing it for her, to secure their future and make sure that they would hold the key to their own destiny. But in a very real sense, he was justifying his own power aspirations, having been the powerless underdog his whole life. Marcia didn't care about Skywalker Ranch. She didn't need or want it. They were already millionaires and had the power to simply enjoy living, and she begged Lucas to let go and just get on with his life. Perhaps it is appropriate that the final scene between Anakin and Padme plays out in a mirror scenario, with all the disastrous repercussions that Lucas endured.
Everybody thought of Darth Vader as this big evil guy that had no heart and that he was just evil, Lucas said in 2005. But in the end, it's not that at all. I mean, here is a guy who has lost everything,
including his wife, his status as chosen one, his friendships, and his former power, now regarded as an isolated technological monster.
You can't write a main character and not have him be a part of you and not be able to identify with him, Lucas once said to Denise Worrell.
Although some of these themes are obviously inspired by other sources, virginal conception, for example, being a common mythological motif in savior legends, and come from other storytelling necessities, Lucas's draw to them might be traced through identification with his own life. Following Phantom Menace's release, Lucas took a much-needed vacation. While the film went on to gross hundreds of millions of dollars and create uproar, both positive and negative, all summer long, Lucas, who had been away from the spotlight for well over a decade and had become regarded as a recluse, was now a media focus, giving interviews on a daily basis and even appearing on talk shows like Rosie O'Donnell. Times had certainly changed. Chapter 12. Stitches. It is no surprise, then, after the harsh treatment of Episode 1, that Lucas would have returned to writing with some trepidation. Perhaps as a direct result of the backlash Phantom Menace received, Lucas mulled over Episode 2 for quite some time, and didn't start writing until the fall, despite the fact that filming would commence in June. Author Jodie Duncan reported that Lucas took a family vacation to Europe just after Phantom Menace's release. But the movie that would become Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, was never far from his thoughts, she wrote. Even while vacationing, Lucas took note of possible locations. In quiet moments, he scribbled down ideas for the as-yet-unwritten screenplay. In fact, he would discover Lake Como while in Italy, which he would later write much of Episode II's romance around. As Episode 1 faded from theaters as the summer waned and Lucas's kids went back to school, he had to finally begin tangible work on the second film in his trilogy. With the script and designs targeted for completion in May 2000, that left only a 9-month pre-production period from the September start, contrasted with the 3 years it took to write and design Phantom Menace. It is unknown how much of Episode 2 was planned beforehand by Lucas, when plotting out the trajectory of the prequel trilogy in the early mid-90s. We can be certain that the first 3 Star Wars sequels, that is, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, and Phantom Menace, were original creations, predominantly made up on the fly, and Episode 3, the film containing most of Lucas's initial prequel ideas, was largely already known by the time he started scripting. However, the gap between Episode 1 and Episode 3 is still largely mysterious in its formation. The broad strokes were known. Anakin and Padme fall in love, the Clone War begins, and the Republic gets its army. Anakin's mother dies, and Palpatine continues his ascent to dictator. But the specifics of the plot still remain somewhat ambiguous in their formative stages. No early drafts are available, save for a shooting script, and Lucas himself has been somewhat tight-lipped about the process, in order to preserve the myth that all was worked out decades prior, and so is not a source of much information on the episode's creative origination. However, it seems that Lucas had enough broad plot strokes to keep himself busy, with his task in crafting Episode 2 mainly being to fill in the specifics. Whereas Episode 1 was likely a more enjoyable process of creating a new story, and Episode 3 a more satisfying process of finally crafting the galaxy's doom, Episode 2 seemed to serve more as a link in the series, filling in the little blanks between the two films. At a glance, examination would seem to indicate that most of the main plot pieces were present, presumably including the Separatists' plot, but only in the vaguest of detail. Tatooine's reappearance was in place from the start, as producer Rick McCallum and production designer Gavin Bouquet scouted Tunisia in the summer of 1999. During that same series of recces, they also visited several lakeside locations in northern Italy, searching for a Naboo summer retreat that would be a pivotal setting in Episode 2. In addition to revisiting Caserta Palace, which had stood in for Theed Palace in the prior film, indicating the related scenes Lucas already had in mind going into the scripting process. The nature of Anakin and Padme's courtship appears to have been created when crafting the arc of the prequels in the 90s. When Episode 1 was released, many fans noticed a shot which placed emphasis on a character watching the pod race, showing a bald, white-skinned alien standing on the edge of a balcony as Anakin zips by in a canyon below. The expanded universe material revealed her to be a character known as bounty hunter Aura Sing, and intrigued, many fans wanted to know more about her. It was soon leaked that she might play a role in Episode 2. Her character became a huge hit with fans, even going as far as getting her own comic series. However, viewers will note that this once obscure character obviously does not appear in Episode 2. Could this character have become Zam Wessel, the female bounty hunter that works with Jango Fett to assassinate Padme? Certainly that fits into the picture. Perhaps because of Aura Sing's popularity, Lucas opted to redesign the female bounty hunter for Episode 2. The fact that she would be killed in the film may have also been a factor, as Aura Sing enjoys a healthy living in her many expanded universe stories. This then would indicate the assassination plot surrounding Padme existed beforehand, which would presumably extend to include Anakin's involvement in her protection and their subsequent falling in love, as the assassination subplot is a device to get the two of them together. In describing Episode 2 beforehand, Lucas frequently called Episode 2 a romance or love story. The wedding of Anakin and Padme was originally to be a bigger focal point and occurred earlier in the initial draft, according to author Marcus Hearn. But Lucas decided that their romance needed to be gradual rather than abrupt, even if the final script itself is rather rapid in the growth of their relationship. Ian McKaig recalled in The Art of Attack of the Clones, "At one point, George said the wedding might be at the center of the conflict, rather than an idyllic moment as in the final film." In addition to returning to Naboo and Coruscant, Episode 2 would feature a significant appearance of Tatooine, and in particular the Lars homestead seen in Star Wars, marking a significant transition in linking the two trilogies together. Tatooine's return would serve as a major turning point for Anakin's character, and would lead to the discovery of many revelations. For starters, his mother has married her new slave owner, Kleeg Lars, leaving Anakin with a stepbrother, Owen Lars. This dashed the previous notion that Owen was in fact Obi-Wan's brother, developed during Return of the Jedi, and even present in that film's novelization, and restored Owen and Beru's status as legitimate relatives of Luke. We also discover that C-3PO was bought by the Larses and works on the farm, further bringing together the characters in the saga. It is also learned that Anakin's mother has been kidnapped by Tusken raiders, and in a sequence derived from John Ford's The Searchers, Anakin ventures out into the Tatooine wilderness to rescue her, only to have her die in his arms as he at last tracks her down. One of the most important story points to finally address was the Clone War. The details of Episode II's clone subplot were probably invented in mid-90s, but likely only in broad strokes. Kamino and the Geonosis subplot may have well been creations devised after Episode I, simply due to the large number of original elements involved. Many feel Lucas's inclusion of Jango and Boba Fett to be an attempt at appeasing fans, since the character had become the most popular individual in the series, citing his seemingly unnecessary insertion into the special edition. In reality, Boba Fett was always tied to the Clone Wars, as was revealed in a Banthatrax issue from 1979, and his insertion into the special edition might have been made with his upcoming prequel role in mind. Playing on his popularity, of course, Lucas enlarged his role as a central figure at the heart of the Clone Wars origins, instead of the former conception where he was an anonymous participant. As early as 1998, Lucas confirmed Boba Fett would feature prominently in the second film. "He's definitely going to play a part in Episode II," Rick McCallum said in the August 1998 issue of Star Wars Insider. "There's a real story point for Boba Fett." On the other hand, the character of Jango Fett, his father, is an entirely new character. Although it is at this time unconfirmed, it seems fairly apparent that Jango wasn't merely added to Episode II, he replaced Boba. Instead, Boba would be his cloned son, who would grow up to fill his father's shoes. The original conception of Boba Fett was that, at the time of the original trilogy, he was somewhat aged, being a veteran combatant of the Clone War era, which would follow if he was in the role that Jango filled. Creating Jango gave Lucas an opportunity to create a new character, and the only villain who could be killed in the film's climax, while bringing an interesting twist to Fett's character and the ongoing father-son theme of the series. Boba Fett's central role clearly foreshadowed an important place in the next film, although, as we will see in the next chapter, Lucas then eliminated him from the story, leaving his prominent appearance in Episode II somewhat unresolved, considering his meager screen time at the end of Empire and beginning of Jedi. The introduction of the clones not only served to lead into the impending Empire's stormtroopers, but also to provide the linchpin in the Jedi's destruction. As Lucas had described way back in 1980, the Jedi were betrayed with some kind of trap set up by the Emperor, a plot point first hinted at in the second draft of Star Wars. Such vague statements are short on details of any kind. Arguably, some kind of ambush or execution seemed implied, which is exactly what would happen when Anakin and the clones march on the Jedi Temple in Episode III. In 1977, Lucas revealed similar details, stating that Vader first began secretly assassinating them, and that after the Jedi initially rebelled and had been decimated, they tried to regroup, but they were eventually massacred by one of the special elite forces led by Darth Vader. However, as many fans were surprised to find, the clones of the infamous Clone Wars were not an outside enemy attacking the Republic, an implication made all the more misleading by the film's eventual title, Attack of the Clones, but the Republic Army itself, and the actual Clone Wars to be a battle fought from within. This seems to be a complete 180 from Lucas's original plan, which went through many permutations from what we know, but always involved some kind of external threat. The first recorded speculation by Lucas occurred when Lando was introduced in Empire Strikes Back. He came from a planet of clones, and it seems either a planetary civil war or the planet's assault on outlying worlds resulted in the galaxy being ravaged. This was dropped and replaced with Boba Fett and the Imperial Shock Troopers, warriors who came from across the galaxy but were wiped out by the Jedi. That they are known as Imperial shock troopers may be misunderstood as implying that they were part of the Galactic Empire. But the fact that it is stated in Bantha tracks that they had a distant origin and were defeated by the Jedi seems to contradict this, aside from the fact that the Empire would not be in place yet. Likely, they belong to another empire on the other side of the galaxy that tried to invade the Republic. A subsequent Lucasfilm publication from 1981, The World of Star Wars, revealed that the stormtroopers were actually cloned human beings. This then presents an interesting possibility. Perhaps the later Boba Fett shock trooper concept was taken even further, with the Jedi now leading the Republic's own clone army against the invading shock troopers. In this later version, circa 1979, the Clone Wars also occurred closer to the Empire's birth, rather than some decades prior. A chronology change that is reinforced by the fact that Boba Fett was implied to have participated in the war, allowing Palpatine to have a ready-made army which eventually became the Imperial Stormtroopers. In any case, Lucas chose to start over almost from scratch on the issue, linking the Clone Wars much closer to Palpatine, the Jedi, and the fall of the Republic, now being an artificial manipulation orchestrated by Palpatine in order to dominate the galaxy. This reveals an interesting example of how the original storylines were being reshaped to reflect the new, personalized conception of the saga. The original Clone Wars, a macro event which was merely a heroic war that Ben Kenobi and Father Skywalker fought in, was now turned into a micro event, which was a personalized plot point surrounding the new storyline, involving Darth Sidious and the Sith's dominance, drawing in all the characters of the story. A clever plot had been engineered by Lucas. Palpatine creates and fosters a civil war in order to manipulate the people into giving him more power in the name of security, all the while controlling and orchestrating both sides. The enemies of this war would be members of a rebellion within the Republic, an alliance of systems that would include the Trade Federation from Episode 1. The Clone Army, then, would be the Army of the Republic, led by the Jedi generals. The second twist came when their true purpose would be revealed in Episode 3. Not only would they give Palpatine a ready-made personal army, but they could be programmed to turn on their former comrades. Lucas explained in a 2005 interview,
"I was always worried in Episode 2 that I was giving away too much in terms of people asking questions about where did the clones really come from. Because if you go back, they mention the fact that Lord Tyrannus and Count Dooku are the same person. You know, Darth Tyrannus. And that Darth Tyrannus is the one who started the clones. So if you are paying attention, it is very easy to figure out what's going to happen to the clones. I mean that they're going to be the ones that betray everybody. Tough to put in things like that without giving everything away."
Another major shock to fans was the inclusion of a lightsaber duel by Yoda. To many viewers, this seemed silly, as did Palpatine's duels in the following film. The characters were thought to be above such physical feats, instead relying on their minds and the Force as their source of power. However, these were, in fact, faithful to Lucas's first conceptions. In the first draft of Empire Strikes Back, Yoda reveals his true nature by fencing in a lightsaber match with the ghost of Ben Kenobi. And in the rough draft of Revenge of the Jedi, the Emperor is revealed to have a lightsaber. The character's subsequent transformation from those early drafts, however, provides merit to the criticisms. A major event in the screenwriting of Episode 2 was the creation of the new Sith apprentice, Count Dooku, also known as Darth Tyrannus. For such a major player in the last two episodes, Dooku was invented considerably late in the game, during the pre-production period of Episode 2. Lucas's outline for Episode 2 must have been merely that Sidious somehow fosters a separatist movement, possibly by manipulating a powerful politician to lead the faction. At the same time, Sidious has found a new Sith apprentice, who duels Yoda and Anakin at the end of the movie, and in the subsequent film, Anakin could finally slay the apprentice and take his place as his final act towards the dark side. though this would inevitably be restructured. The new Sith apprentice was at first thought to be similar to Darth Maul in the previous film, powerful and menacing, but whom served little plot use other than providing a threat and dueling the heroes at the film's conclusion. Likely, the new apprentice was to oversee the Separatist leader, similar to the way Maul protected and kept an eye on Newt Gunray and the Nemoidians in Episode 1. The art department went back to some unused designs from Episode 1, namely the popular Sith Witch design, which would eventually find its way into the Clone War cartoon series as Asajj Ventress. At one point, Lucas suggested a robot cyborg, indicating he was interested in the concept that would eventually become General Grievous in the following film. However, Lucas soon drastically changed his plan, offering concept artists the idea that the new Sith would be a completely different character played by Christopher Lee. The apprentice could be the opposite of the fearsome and acrobatic Maul, instead a thinking man, older, and with a sense of elegance and regality. Whether before or after this happened, it seems Lucas struck upon a much more interesting direction to take things. The Separatist leader and the Sith apprentice would be the same person. Thus was born Count Dooku, also known as Darth Tyrannus. Once again, we see a similar situation and process which led to the merging of Father Skywalker and Darth Vader in 1978, or to the merging of General Darth Vader and Prince Valorum in 1974, as character and story redundancies are simplified. In Dooku, Lucas created one of the prequel's most fascinating characters. An elderly Jedi Knight, who left the Order after becoming disillusioned with the Republic, he is picked up by Sidious, who tells him of his plans to create a new order and thus rid the Republic of its corruption. Dooku secretly joins the Sith, becoming Darth Tyrannus, and creates the Separatist movement. Later, during pickup shooting, Lucas would write that he was also Qui-Gon's master, probably an inspiration taken from a scene in which Jocasta Nu compares the two, adding further complexity, and perhaps linking Qui-Gon's outsider tendencies as a trait picked up from Dooku, creating an interesting relationship between Dooku and Obi-Wan and Anakin. In effect, Lucas combined Palpatine and Anakin into a new character, a Jedi who becomes a Sith while also being a political figure and master manipulator with a secret identity. Lucas also developed an interesting history that would be cut out of the final film, that of the Lost 20. The scene is portrayed in the shooting script. Interior, Jedi Temple, Archives Library, Day. A bronze bust of Count Dooku stands among a line of other busts of Jedi in the archive room. Obi-Wan studies the bust for a few moments before Madame Jocasta Nu, the Jedi archivist, is standing next to him. She is an elderly, frail-looking human Jedi, tough as old boots and smart as a whip. Jocasta Nu, did you call for assistance? Obi-Wan, distracted in thought. Yes, I did. Jocasta Nu, he has a powerful face, doesn't he? He was one of the most brilliant Jedi I have had the privilege of knowing. Obi-Wan, I never understood why he quit. Only 20 Jedi have ever left the Order. Jocasta Nu, the Lost 20. And Count Dooku was the most recent and the most painful. No one likes to talk about it. His leaving was a great loss to the Order. Obi-Wan, what happened? Jocasta Nu, well, one might say he was always a bit out of step with the decisions of the Council. Much like your old master, Qui-Gon Jinn. Obi-Wan, really? Jocasta Nu, oh yes, they were alike in many ways, very individual thinkers. Jocasta Nu stares at the bust. Jocasta Nu, he was always striving to become a more powerful Jedi. He wanted to be the best. With a lightsaber, in the old style of fencing, he had no match. His knowledge of the Force was unique. In the end, I think he left because he lost faith in the Republic. He believed that politics were corrupt, and he felt the Jedi betrayed themselves by serving the politicians. He always had very high expectations of government. He disappeared.